So I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. We are in Capitol Room 124. I have members present, Representative Mears, Representative Dibert, Representative Wright, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. We have a quorum to do business. Let's see, I'd like to thank the staff today, Lisa and Justin, and committee aide Ed King for helping us keep the meeting on track. And remind everyone to please silence your cell phones. Today we have a presentation, a pretty special presentation that I've actually seen several years ago that's very interesting. We have the honor of hearing from Mr. Alex Epstein today. I am grateful for his willingness to speak with us. I requested his presentation to help balance the scales in terms of the debate that we've been having in the building since January. Mr. Epstein is a national best-selling author and world-renowned philosopher. He offers an alternative perspective of the current state of industrial progress and environmental concerns. He has made his moral case for fossil fuels to dozens of university campuses, several Fortune 500 companies, and to the U.S. Congress. I'm pleased to have him add the Alaska legislature to that impressive list. So, Mr. Epstein, without further ado, please state your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your presentation. And I would remind us we're going to try to be done at 2 o'clock Alaska time, which is about 40 minutes from now.
My name is Alex Epstein. I'm founder and president of the Center for Industrial Progress. Just one question. So, we can do Q&A, right? I'm not planning on talking the whole time. I mean, I want to give a presentation, but then give people plenty of time to ask questions. I assume that's okay?
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay, and then somebody is there to move the slides?
Yes, we can move slides, right? Yeah, we could do that.
The first slide has limited information on it. So, yeah, actually keep moving ahead of that because that's a video. I don't want to spend time in the video now. Next one. Okay, so we'll go there for now. So thanks for having me.
We've been joined by Representative Sadler. Excuse me, Mr. Epstein. Please proceed.
Okay, sure. So what I want to do is, I know there are lots of local issues that you face. I want to start off by giving my global view of the future of energy and climate, particularly as it relates to the question of what to do about fossil fuels. And so a lot of the local questions are informed by global issues, including just this global push to, usually it's called net zero by 2050, which in practice means rapidly eliminating fossil fuels. And I want to share my perspective and way of thinking, which has led me to the opposite conclusion that actually global fossil fuel use should be expanding over the next several decades. That doesn't mean forever, but I think in particular over the next several decades, the world would be much better off if fossil fuel use expands, and implications for Alaska are that we need more fossil fuel from Alaska and that a lot of the anti-Alaskan policies are extremely dangerous. And you can ask me in the Q&A, I think Alaska's the biggest victim right now of really bad national energy policies. But just speaking of the global thing, and I admit this is a very controversial conclusion because the mainstream conclusion we're taught is we need to rapidly eliminate fossil fuels on a 2050 timetable. And I'm saying, well, no, we should be increasing fossil fuels. I'm saying 180 degree opposite of what we're told is kind of the consensus. I don't think it actually is the consensus among people who actually know what they're talking about. I think it gets distorted by various institutions. To give you a sense of how I reach this, I want to start off with one very simple idea, because this is really the idea that's the basis of my conclusion. The interesting thing about this idea is that nobody has ever disagreed with it, and yet I think most so-called experts in my field do not apply it at all. So this is a thinking method. My background, as the intro person said, is philosophy, and so I'm very interested in thinking methods and understanding good thinking methods versus bad ones, as well as assumptions and values that often underlie good or bad thinking methods. And so in this case, it's just a very common sense thinking method. It's the same one you'd use when deciding whether to take a prescription drug, which is that you carefully weigh the benefits and side effects of your alternative. So you look at the drug, you carefully look at the benefits, you look at the side effects, you weigh them, you do the same for your alternatives, and you make a decision. And I assume nobody disagrees with this. And yet my argument is when it comes to fossil fuels, and in particular climate, almost everyone is in massive violation of this. So if you go to the next slide. I'll make sure that I can, I know this slide well, but I'm going to pull up my own slides on my own side just because it's, that screen is a little bit fuzzy from my perspective. So I'm just going to pull this up right now. Okay. So I have this up. So if we think about carefully weighing benefits and side effects when it comes to fossil fuels and climate, I think there are three principles that everyone would agree with. And I'm just focused today on fossil fuels and climate, because while there are other side effects of fossil fuel use that people are concerned about, I think legitimately, like air pollution and water pollution, these aren't the issues that are causing people to have a global movement to eliminate fossil fuels. So all around this issue of climate, sort of focus on that. Feel free to ask about any other aspect later. So I think if we're thinking about carefully weighing benefits and side effects, there are three irrefutable principles. Again, nobody's ever disagreed with these, and yet almost nobody follows them. And so the first one is that when we're thinking about fossil fuels and climate, we have to factor in fossil fuels benefits, including unique benefits, or especially unique benefits they have that others don't have, other things don't have. And one example here I think that's very important is agriculture. So fossil fuels are uniquely valuable today for agriculture in at least two major forms. One is that natural gas is the basis of modern fertilizer that allows us to feed 8 billion people. There's no equivalent right now of natural gas for feeding 8 billion people. And then the other one is diesel fuel for machinery, such as a combine harvester that can reap and thresh enough wheat as much wheat as it used to take 1,000 manual laborers to do. So you have these things where fossil, and nothing today is close to diesel in terms of performance and scale or anything like that. So you have these unique benefits of fossil fuels, and yet it's commonplace to talk about rapidly eliminating fossil fuels very, very quickly, less than 27 years now, without considering these benefits. And an example I like to give in chapter one of my book, Fossil Future, is a guy named Michael Mann, who's one of the leading activists on this issue. He's a climate scientist, but he comments on these things, and he has a whole book about fossil fuels and climate called The Madhouse Effect. And in that book, he only talks about negative side effects of fossil fuels in agriculture. He literally mentions fertilizer and diesel fuel zero times. So how can you possibly make a good decision if you're totally ignoring the huge benefits of something? Yet this is very commonplace with fossil fuels. The next principle is what I call factoring in the climate mastery benefits. So we're always talking about fossil fuels and climate in a negative way. But if you think about how we use fossil fuels, a lot of what we do is it's very positive in terms of how livable our climate is, because a lot of what we do with fossil fuels is we neutralize climate danger. So take some, heating and air conditioning are examples. In Alaska, certainly with heating, how many lives does that save? And you have that kind of thing, but also building sturdy buildings. Maybe the biggest one is irrigation systems and crop transport to alleviate drought. Drought-related deaths are down 99% compared to what they were a century ago. So a lot of what we do with fossil fuels is we make our climate more livable. I call this climate mastery. And yet, it's not discussed. But how can you possibly discuss fossil fuels and climate without this? I have a thing coming out tomorrow on what's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Synthesis Report, which is supposedly this great synthesis of all the information about our impacts on climate. They don't factor in our mastery at all. So they just totally ignore the fact that fossil fuels have actually made us safer from climate. They ignore that. But you can't think about a side effect without a benefit, and you especially can't think about a side effect where it gets cured by the benefit. In the case of fossil fuels, it can have negative climate impacts, but then it can also be, those can be neutralized or more than offset by the benefits. So that's another huge one where I think just most people talking about this are wrong. And then the final one is that we need to look at the climate impacts of fossil fuels. We need to do so with even-handedness and precision. So even-handedness means negative, not just negative, but positive as well. I think there's overwhelming focus on negative, but almost nobody talks about the significant benefits of greening of the globe or of warming on a planet where far more people die of cold than of heat. And so there's just, and that, so that's a, another bias. And then the precision, there's just a very big tendency of people speaking about this publicly, like Al Gore, to just totally distort any kind of scientific claim out of all proportion. So Al Gore's movie portrays sea levels as they're going to rise 20 feet in the next few decades. That's nowhere in any science, even the most extreme kind of projections. But Gore is doing it. Those kinds of projections, are over thousands of years. But Gore is doing it to scare people. So what we can see is there's this tendency to not factor in the benefits, not factor in the fossil fuel benefits, not look at the positives of climate, just look at the negatives and then exaggerate them. And in my work, I sometimes call this ignoring the benefits and catastrophizing the side effects. And so my view, if we go to the next slide, you guys have an older version of my presentation. Is there any way that can be more focused?
I don't turn on the lights or.
let me just see if I can.
I can read it to you. It's my contention: if you apply these irrefutable principles to the et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Very interesting. Do you know the title of the document by any chance?
It's got the picture of your book, Fossil Future, by Alex Epstein.
Yeah. No, I know that part of it. I think I can do it. So sorry about this confusion. I'm not sure. We must have gotten confused. So does it say my contention if we apply these irrefutable principles?
Yes, that's the slide we're on.
Okay, I think I found the version. Okay, so my contention, as you might expect, is if we apply these principles, it's actually obvious that we need more fossil fuel, not less. And I think it's really a matter of this is the issue, that people are not thinking about it in a way that's defensible, so they're only looking at negatives and then exaggerating them, and then not looking at positives. And I think if you look at the facts from the perspective, you really want to weigh the benefits and side effects like you would for a prescription drug, you have a totally different evaluation. Next slide. So what I'm going to do is I'll share, very quickly, what I think are 10 undeniable facts. And I want to say that with every single thing I'm sharing today, these are all totally referenced and available at a website I highly, highly recommend called energytalkingpoints.com. And that website has references and points on every issue you can imagine. There's also a newsletter you can sign up for. If you want the best version of the newsletter, just email me directly at alex@alexepstein.com, subject Alaska, and I'll make sure you get everything. So alex@alexepstein.com, subject Alaska. So I'm going to share these facts, but I just want to say I can give you, there's a lot more detail on this, but I want to just give you an overview of what I think the crucial facts are that people are not paying attention to. So I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. Next slide. So first one, and I have 90 pages about this in my book, Fossil Future. Also, if any of you individually want a copy of Fossil Future, just email me, alex@alexepstein.com, and request one. I think at least for federal giving, it doesn't violate any rules because it's educational. I don't know Alaska's situation. So don't violate any rules, but I'm happy to send you one if it follows the rules. So cost-effective energy is essentially human flourishing. This is a very involved idea, but the basic is cost-effective energy means affordable, so most people can afford to use a significant amount of it. Reliable, we can get energy when we need it and the amount we need it. Versatile, which means you can use it for any type of machine, not just machines that use electricity, which right now electricity is just 1/5 of the world's energy use. And then scalable, available to billions of people in thousands of places. So my argument is the more cost-effective energy is, the more affordable, reliable, versatile, scalable, the more human beings can flourish on Earth. And by flourish, I mean live to our potential, in particular living long lives, healthy lives, and opportunity-filled lives where we can potentially achieve fulfillment. I don't think energy can make you fulfilled, but I think it can give you a lot more opportunity. The basic reason is because the more cost-effective energy is, the cheaper it is to power machines, and the more people can use machines to be productive and prosperous. If you think about food, clothing, shelter, education, medical care, every single field benefits from cheaper energy because we can be more productive and prosperous. We also free up more time so we can have more specialists in more fields. We couldn't have millions of people in medicine without being so productive in agriculture and in home building and in water purification, those kinds of things. I really think this is the root of so many things, is how cost effective energy is. It's also crucial to a good environment. We use low cost, reliable energy to purify naturally dirty water and make it clean, naturally distant water. And we pump naturally distant water and make it available. So there's a lot to say about this, but this is, I believe, very undervalued, how cost-effective energy is and how much it benefits us, including our environment and how healthy and safe our environment are. I think it's very, very underrated. So next slide. And the next point is that billions of people lack cost-effective energy. This is a thing that's totally crucial for humans to be able to flourish, and yet the vast majority of the world doesn't have nearly enough. We have 6 billion people using less electricity than typical American refrigerator. So 6 billion people using an amount of energy we would consider unacceptable. 3 billion people using an amount of electricity that's less than an American refrigerator. A third of the world, as we can see here, using wood and animal dung as their primary heating and cooking fuel. So the world just needs so much more energy, and yet we're talking about getting rid of our leading source. Next slide, which brings me to fossil fuels, which is that fossil fuels are a uniquely cost-effective source of energy. Now, this one is more contested, but it's not really contestable. If you look at the facts, so fossil fuels provide 80% of the world's energy. They're still growing despite a century of aggressive competition, despite enormous cultural and political hostility. They are still growing. They're still popular because no industry is close to what the fossil fuel industry is in terms of energy that's affordable, reliable, versatile, and scalable. This is why, for example, China, which is the world leader in producing solar and wind, overwhelmingly has a grid powered by coal. They're investing in a lot more coal. They're investing in more coal, new coal, than we have on our entire grid. So if solar and wind are so easily able to replace fossil fuels, then why is China using coal to produce solar and wind? Next slide. And actually go to the next slide after that. I just want to make sure we get through this pretty quickly. So next slide is people say, yes, solar and wind are replacing fossil fuels rapidly. This is just false. So fossil fuels are failing to rapidly replace fossil fuel energy. If you look at solar and wind, they're used in large quantities only when they get major government preferences, whether it's subsidies, mandates. I believe today's grid policies are all messed up in favor of preferring solar and wind because they allow solar and wind to sell unreliable electricity for the same price or a greater price than others sell reliable electricity, that's like if you could rent a car that only works a third of the time and you got paid the same or more as for a car that works all the time. So they get incredible preferences. That's part of their growth. You see that there's consistent pattern of prices going up when you're using more solar and wind. And the basic reason is because you have to pay for the unreliable solar grid, but then you also have to pay for a reliable grid as well. Next slide, and then actually go to the one after that. I think the Texas situation in 2021 really captures a lot. So you see the week before the freeze, at different points, Texas is providing half of its electricity at any given moment through solar and wind. And so the people say, oh, let's just double or triple it, and then it'll be fine. But then you see, once you have a winter storm, it's not just the wind turbines freeze. You can avoid that, but the wind died down. And so at one point, solar and wind were operating at less than 1% of their theoretical capacity. But if they can go to basically zero at any given time, that means to be fully reliable, you need 100% backup, or including batteries. But batteries, we can talk about, are very non-economic right now. So it basically means fossil fuels. And so what happens is you have to build the two grids, as I mentioned. You have to build the reliable grid. And in the unreliable grid, you have all these infrastructure duplication costs. And then if you try to cut back on the reliable grid, which Texas did and which California, where I live, was done, then it's what I call reliability chicken. You're just hoping the sun shines enough, the wind blows enough, doesn't get too hot, doesn't get too cold. And that's bound to fail. So what you have is this bad thing where not only are prices driven up, but then also the real cost you pay is reliability, which we're seeing more and more problems around the country, including, you know, in Texas, they paid something like $11,000 per household for that storm, let alone the lives lost in 2021. So their actual real cost of electricity is just catastrophically high because they've been trying to incorporate as much solar and wind as possible versus trying to have the most cost-effective electricity possible. Also, part of it is they did not sufficiently weatherize their grid as against a place like Alberta, Canada, but in part the money is going from that to paying exorbitant amounts of money for solar and wind and transportation infrastructure. So again, solar and wind are nowhere near rapidly replacing fossil fuels. They're performing quite poorly just in the realm of electricity, which is one-fifth of the world's energy. Next slide. And the final thing that's really, really important with the benefits of fossil fuels. So we have already, fossil fuels are just crucial if billions of people are going to have the energy they need to flourish. But a key part of this is, yeah, fossil fuels also help us master the climate. This is one of my favorite charts. It shows that as we've emitted more CO2 and had somewhat of a warming impact on the planet, what are called climate-related disaster deaths have gone way down. So deaths from storms and floods, extreme heat, extreme cold, et cetera. And it's largely because we've used fossil fuels to take the naturally dangerous climate and make it unnaturally safe through things like drought relief, you know, crop transport, irrigation, through building sturdy buildings, weather warning systems, heating and cooling. we're so good at mastering climate that we have 100 million people who can live below high tide sea level. What this means then is that any negative impacts we have going forward are not really going to be a big problem, because whatever impact we've had so far, we're safer than ever from climate. So why, if it goes up half a degree or a degree or a degree and a half, why would you expect it to get terrible? It's very implausible. The only way that could happen is if the changes so far are totally different from the future changes, and the future changes are a total difference in kind from what's happened before. So really, there's a huge burden of proof on the climate catastrophists. It's not just showing that we impact climate, which I definitely think we do, but it's that we have such an overwhelming and different climate impact that we can't possibly cope with it. And it's that's the only thing that could justify making billions of people suffer by restricting their freedom to use fossil fuels. So when we're thinking about climate, it's really the burden of proof is not on advocates of fossil fuels to prove there's no climate impact. We don't have to prove that at all, because lots of climate impact are totally consistent with fossil fuels being great, because we can master climate impact. You have to prove that there's just a total apocalyptic, overwhelming impact. I think if you look at the science from that perspective, there's nothing resembling that. So go two slides ahead. Another slide. So I'm just going to go through some basic facts about climate. These are all mainstream climate science. They're just either exaggerated by different media institutions, or they're ignored when they're convenient. These are not from political sources. These are all from primary data sources or from mainstream sources. So fact one is we've had, if you look at the actual amount of warming we've had, about 1 degree C, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, that's not a lot of warming on a human scale. So you can see here that this shows how much warming has occurred on the scale of human temperatures, and you can see the variation in New York. So there hasn't been a whole lot of warming. There has been significant greening. It only looks like a lot of warming if you just have a very small y-axis of 1 degree, because then you can make it look like that. But that's very misleading. But NASA and others do this kind of thing all the time. So, okay, that's what we've actually had so far with our CO2 emissions and our fossil fuel use and whatever else is going on in the climate. Next slide. Now, people tend to think, okay, well, yeah, it hasn't been that much, but any amount is going to be really harmful to warm, and in part it's going to be, well, people are going to get too hot and stuff. But you look at right now, we have far more cold-related deaths than heat-related deaths. And so for the foreseeable future, more warming, if it's evenly distributed, is going to save more lives than it takes. And then you might think, oh, it's not going to be evenly distributed. It's going to be distributed in the hot places. And that's actually the exact opposite of the truth. So it's not evenly distributed. Next slide. But this is from bidensclimate.gov. So this is not from some right-wing source. This shows, warming is distributed more in colder regions during colder times of day, during colder seasons. So that means even more it's going to be benign, because it's mostly going to be thawing in places that are less warm. We can talk about sea level rise in a minute, but in terms of temperature, this makes it a lot less of a danger. And then people are like, okay, well, fine, maybe that's going to happen, but isn't it going to go out of control? So aren't we at just the beginning of an exponential thing, but it's just going to go out of control, and then the planet is going to burn? And this is what you'd think from the media, but this is the exact opposite of climate science. So next slide. So what all climate models agree on, there's a lot they disagree on, but what all the models agree on is that warming is diminishing, or what's called logarithmic. So basically, every new molecule of CO2 has less warming power than the last. You get diminishing returns. So as you add more CO2, it warms more, but it warms more and more slowly. So it's kind of like once you're pressing your accelerator on a gasoline car after 55 miles an hour, you get diminishing returns pushing it down. You can't just push it down and go to 1,000 miles an hour. You have to use more and more energy to get a smaller and smaller increase in speed. And so there's a comparable thing here with more and more CO2 to get a certain increase in temperature. So even in the more extreme projections, warming levels off over time. It's not that the planet burns up, which that should be pretty obvious, because we know from history that we've had 10 times more CO2 in the atmosphere, and life thrived on Earth, and Earth didn't burn up. So that's not a plausible thing at all. It's just a total fiction that is scaring a lot of people. And so then the only real thing we can be concerned about with climate is not the world is going to burn up and all these kinds of things. It's that the warming will lead to other consequences that are really bad. So next slide. But we should be skeptical of this, given we've had warming for a while. I mean, we've had warming and we've had ice melting for a while, and life has gotten better, so why should we expect to get worse? And if you look even at the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is very extreme, I think, and it's, very wrong, I think, or biased often, their extreme sea level rise projections are 3 feet a century. That's not something that'd be a huge problem for human beings to deal with over a century. And then, you know, they project storms being 1 to 10% more powerful, which is not something that's going to overwhelm human beings. And with the sea level rises, again, we have 100 million people already living below high tide sea level. So, next slide. This, once you use this basic method, and actually go to the next slide after that. Once you use this basic method of carefully weighing the benefits and side effects, and you really look at fossil fuels that way, I think it's really obvious that the benefits are so much greater than the side effects, that just as we've made the world better in the last 40, 50 years by using fossil fuels, including safer and climate, that's going to be the same over the next several decades. And we should not be restricting the freedom to use fossil fuels. We should be enthusiastic about alternatives, above all, just because we need a lot more energy. And the key there is we want energy freedom. So I believe in freedom for fossil fuels and for other forms of energy, including nuclear and hydro and geothermal, which often get opposed by the so-called green movements. So I believe if we have energy freedom, we'll be able to expand energy availability around the world. In the next few decades, a lot of that will be from fossil fuels. Eventually, you'll be able to come up with even better alternatives and have even more energy in the world. So I think that's the really optimistic vision that's possible. I think the way we're going of rapidly eliminating fossil fuels, what that's going to do is only certain places are going to do it, probably Europe and the U.S. We're going to undercut ourselves. We're going to undercut our security. We're going to impoverish ourselves. China, India, and Russia won't follow suit at all, but we're going to be much more vulnerable, particularly to China and Russia. So it's really this unilateral act of sacrifice that we're performing. If you actually care about lowering emissions long term, you need to focus on liberating innovation, not restricting the most cost-effective thing, which today for most people in most circumstances is fossil fuels. Next slide. And next slide. So just one quick note about today's situation. I think right now we've got a really amazing opportunity because people are more open to these ideas than I think they've ever been, at least in my 16 years on this issue. And in part because we have a global energy crisis that's pretty clearly caused by anti-fossil fuel policies. So people are open to, hey, maybe there's a better way of thinking about it. Energy is really top of mind right now. So I think this is a great opportunity to educate people, including people of Alaska, people of the United States, on how to think of these things better. Next slide. So one resource that I have is called Fossil Future. So it's this book. And again, I'm happy to send any of you a copy of it for free. Just, anyone in the legislature, just email me, alex@alexepstein.com, and just tell me where to send your book. So that's one resource that's really valuable. Also, students, by the way, if any students end up watching this, you can get free copies at fossilfuture.com. Also, people can buy copies at my website. And the next slide. And the number one resource I want to advocate is a thing called energytalkingpoints.com, which is really every truth I can think about and find on energy in a very, very concise form with good references that you can access anytime. And the next implementation of this, if you sign up for the newsletter, and particularly if those of you who are in the house, if you email me and just put Alaska and get on the special newsletter, you'll get access to something soon called AlexGPT, which is actually a chat bot like ChatGPT, except it has really, really good answers on all of these issues. So I'm hoping that in the near future, you guys will be using this on the floor to educate yourself and others. Next slide. And so just the only one you need to worry about here is alex@alexepstein.com. If you have any questions for me, just email me at alex@alexepstein.com. So that's my overall thing. I think the key idea is we need to carefully weigh the benefits and side effects, including the overall benefits, the climate mastery benefits, and then look at side effects on climate with even-handedness and precision. And if we do that, I think it's very clear that today's energy policy is exactly wrong and that we need energy freedom, including more freedom to use fossil fuels. So that's my idea that I want to share, and I would love any questions anyone has.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Epstein, for always exciting presentation. So now's our chance. Who wants to go first? Representative Wright?
Thank you, Chair, through the Chair. Mr. Epstein, you talked about catastrophic levels of the sea raising. Is there a tolerance? Like, is there you said over 100 years, 3 feet. Is there, what's bad? I just need to know.
What would be bad?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what would be bad is it's just how quickly you can deal with things. So I think, like, what would be scary? So general sea level rise is one of these things that's mostly negative, depending on how well you've built your infrastructure and how, sort of how flexible you've been in your planning. Because with sea levels, you do make the infrastructure in accordance with the current sea level. So unlike warming, which has real benefits to it, and other climate changes can have real benefits, sea level rise doesn't really have much in the way of benefit. So I think the main thing is just that it's slow. Like, if in my book, I talk about if it were, you know, more than a foot a decade, that would be really scary. At the moment, it's a foot a century. And so that's pretty slow. And if you just look at the productive ability of the world, that stuff you can adjust to. But it's all in the context of you're not choosing any of these things in isolation. You're choosing them because it's a side effect largely of the energy that you use. Mm-hmm. So for me, the energy that you get is far more important in protecting people from flooding, which is one of the main things you're afraid of with sea level rise. That's far more important than having a certain pace of sea level rise. And that's why, for example, flood-related deaths are way down. Flood damages are flat or down over time.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Armstrong.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. Through the chair, just a couple of things. Did you get? I'll ask a question, then I have some comments. Did you spend time looking at the Alaska context when you were writing Fossil Future? I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
Well, I've spent some time thinking about the Alaska context. So in a sense, I was doing it when I was writing Fossil Future. Fossil Future is very global, but for example, I've had discussions with people in Alaska. I had a public discussion with Governor Dunleavy on my podcast Power Hour. We talked about it. So as I mentioned before, I think Alaska is very mistreated by the rest of the country. And in particular, I think the rest of the country has this idea that Alaska should be some sort of untouched museum and that people don't actually live there. And so people have these romantic ideas about, quote, the Arctic, and it should never be touched. And I think that's very harmful to Alaskans as well as the rest of the country. So that's the level of my perspective on it.
Okay, follow up, Rep. Armstrong.
Thank you for that. I guess I just wanted to share a few things because one of your central arguments is that fossil fuel development is central to human flourishing, and we're already one of the top oil-producing states. Yes, yet we rank last in a lot of areas for human flourishing, domestic violence, sexual assault, children abuse and neglect, suicide. I could go on and on. And then I also just can't help but to look at countries like Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, all of these fossil fuel producing countries. And so that's just a tough connection for me to make there. And then the other side of that is cost-effective energy. Again, one of the top oil producing states, yet we have some of the highest energy costs in the country. And we spend $20 to $40 million a year subsidizing diesel energy in rural communities. Meanwhile, we are sitting in Juneau, Alaska right now, which has some of the cheapest electricity in the state, and it relies mostly on hydroelectric power. So I think I understand where you're coming from in certain scenarios, but Alaska is a really unique context. And so I think a lot of this just didn't hit for me here, but would be interested to hear from my other colleagues on their thoughts as well.
Yeah, let me comment on some of that. So first of all, like, my view, as I said, is I want the most cost-effective source of energy. So hydro is often a great source of energy. The problem is it's not scalable everywhere because places don't always have the topography for it. So where you can use hydro, it's generally a good thing to use hydro and has lots and lots of advantages. There are lots of difficulties about the Alaskan situation in particular, and I'm definitely not an expert in Alaskan history, but since you brought up examples like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and stuff like this, so those are clear-cut examples of, I think, something that applies everywhere, which is that that culture and in particular policy are crucial to these things. So if you're a place like Texas where you have good property rights, then having like a fossil fuel industry can be really, really beneficial. And if you have messed up situation or you have situations where people are getting exploited, it can be used very problematically. But I want to emphasize the core of my argument is not being a fossil fuel producer as a state is good, although all things being equal, being any successful industry as a state is good versus not having a successful industry. The main thing is that having the availability of cost-effective energy is crucial. And so there, that is universal, and anything you can think of that is good would depend on that. I mean, even something like you're talking about domestic violence. Well, if you could improve policies, if you need more police, well, more prosperity comes from cost-effective energy. That means more police or education. More education comes from more cost-effective energy. So in general, the thing I'm focused on, cost-effective energy, that the availability of that is always crucial to human flourishing. It's true that you can have an industry that's involved in cost-effective energy that can be used or abused in a harmful way. But that we see, we know that's solvable with policy. The solution is not to blame oil, of all things, for Saudi Arabia's problems. It's for Saudi Arabia to reform.
Thank you. I appreciate. Oh, I'm sorry. Follow up.
Oh, go ahead, Representative.
Through the chair. There's a really interesting theory around the resource curse that I think would be worth diving into. I guess the final thing I would say, I am pro-responsible resource development. It is really important in our state, and I am pro-renewables and pro-nuclear, and I think that vilifying certain types of energy is not the path forward for Alaska to have the most efficient energy. I think the most useful conversation is for us to talk about the different, we have we're a huge state, and we need to be looking at multiple pathways and looking at all of them and considering them equally. Thank you.
So, Representative Armstrong, I think that the quality of life in Alaska before the Alaska pipeline and before statehood, which was given to us by oil, was probably a lot rougher than you might realize. And many of us would like to have the, is it the Guantanamo Dam? But the environmental community continues to block us from building that dam. So there are things that we could do up here to alleviate some of your concerns. Representative Dybert.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Epstein, for your presentation, and I look forward to reading your book. I have a few thoughts on mentioning just the climate in Alaska is a, you know, a special place, and it's been cold for a long time, and I'm Quakon Athabascan Indian, and my, you know, my family's been in the state for a long, long time, many, many years, and some of the things that are affecting our rural communities in Alaska, such most recently is traveling on our waterways. Usually they're frozen, and our hunters are traveling across waterways that used to be frozen, and now it's dangerous to navigate on, you know, the change of that. Also, my family subsists salmon on the Yukon River, and we haven't had salmon go up our river for, we haven't been able to fish for the past 5 years or so. Those are huge effects that are affecting our rural villages in Alaska. And I guess a question is, in your research and going through the writing of your book, I was just wondering, like, how do you connect with rural villages and communities across the world in your study, just to have that connection with the people that this is affecting? Thank you.
I'm curious, what do you think, so assuming that it's emissions that are causing it, what do you think should be done about it? Like, should the world, should, like, China and India not industrialize so that people can keep the exact same lifestyle they had in rural Alaska?
Okay. Through the chair. Thank you. I'm just curious, like, in your study of this, have you, you know, do you talk to villages and smaller communities and how to work with them? We have very high cost of energy in Alaska. I guess that's my question. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so some, but I would admit that the people I talk to from those villages are skewed. More reach out to me because they agree with me than disagree with me, so I'm not engaged as much with the people who disagree with me. I mean, in general, I'm a believer in progress and in human capability, including adaptation. And so, in general, what happens over time is people seek ways of life that allow them to be more prosperous and more adaptable. And it's certainly not just climate related. It's even like economic related. Like, well, if if you're producing a certain crop, but then other people figure out how to produce it more quickly, you're producing certain fish, you know, you have wild fish in your area, but then people can farm fish much more efficiently. They'll do it. Or maybe they create better ways of getting wild fish than you have. So the more primitive a lifestyle is, I think the more it's going to be quote unquote threatened by progress. But I think that's generally a good thing. And then you want to think about with any given lifestyle, hey, what are the good elements of this that we want to preserve? and what are the bad elements that we don't. But as I indicated with my question, I think if in general the world needs something to flourish and progress, I don't think that people in a certain area who want to keep their lifestyle exactly the same have a right to tell the rest of the people, hey, you can't do what you need to flourish and progress because we want to do the exact same thing. And again, this is not just about climate. It's about any economic thing. I don't think economic communities have the right to say, like, for example, if fossil fuels get surpassed by nuclear, the fossil fuel people don't have the right to say, hey, let's just keep using fossil fuels because we want to keep our current lifestyle. I don't think you have the right to do that. So I think in general, I don't know how many of these specific consequences are global. Often climate things are local, much more so than global, because local changes have to be much bigger than global. But if it is a global change, I still think it's in the category of thing that, yeah, people should adapt to. And in general, they should be improving their lives and living a less vulnerable way of life.
Okay, Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Epstein, I appreciate your energetic and high pace and a very thoughtful presentation. You've asked the question, what's our perception or what's our views? I'm going to say that I think that what you're presenting is a well-reasoned look at the problem. Anytime I see everyone say, yeah, everyone believes, or the science is settled, or there's no doubt that, I get immediately suspicious. And when I hear people say things like, we simply have to abandon oil, we simply have to not do coal, not do natural gas, and we will power ourselves with renewables. That's a nice aspiration, but I don't think it's factual. I think you bring a high energy perspective to these things. I think people would like to achieve benefits, but don't realize what they've got before they lose it. I agree with your point. I don't want to go through your whole presentation, but I understand the Green Revolution and the phosphate fertilizers have been able to us to feed and survive and to support the sustenance of millions of people. As opposed to a previous subsistence, a hunter-gatherer culture, we are able to support people in cities by mass fossil fuel, diesel-fueled agriculture. It's a good thing. And I'm concerned that people want to put those benefits in their pocket, but then turn around and say we cannot possibly accept the downsides while not acknowledging the benefits. So I think you probably get a fair amount of pushback from the general consensus of people that fossil fuels are terrible. We have to abandon oil. We have to get rid of it by some time in the future. So I appreciate you bringing a fact-based approach to these things. And I think if we're going to have a fair, reasonable conversation, it's an inconvenient truth that we do depend on fossil fuels for our economy, for our prosperity, for our health, for our sustenance in many, many ways. And if we're going to have consistency and integrity, your perspective needs to be as much at the table as Al Gore's. So we have a broad
Thank
conversation.
You. I look forward to that level of distribution by the American school system.
Thank you, sir. Don't hold your breath.
Okay, I want to get everybody, Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Repstein. I agree a little bit more broadly that access to energy has got a lot of benefits, production and preservation of food, transportation, clean water, all sorts of things along that line. One of the problems with fossil fuels is that it's not available everywhere, so there needs to be transportation distribution. Here in Alaska, that's one of the challenges we have, that we have such a large, diverse state where there's lots of areas that aren't easy to get to. We also have declining oil production, declining natural gas production. So when we're looking at our situation here in Alaska, there's a couple of things to consider. When we are going out to rural communities that are importing diesel, if we've got the opportunity to be able to generate energy on site, you know, with solar, tidal, you know, river currents, you know, whatever that might be, or even biomass through, you know, wood stoves, that's something that's pretty critical to be able to keep energy prices low. We've also really seen, when we're looking just at fossil fuels, those prices and availability can spike rapidly. So the more diverse our energy portfolio is, including fossil fuels, I think the better off we are. Thank you.
I mean, the way I think of it is, as I put it, you want energy freedom, and that means the freedom to use the most cost-effective things. Sometimes people talk about all of the above, but I don't really like that, because do you really want to use, like, animal dung? That's one of the above. I mean, it's really you want to use all of the cost-effective. And I think, though, with a couple of the limitations. So the limitations you're mentioning that are geographic in terms of, well, it's a huge state, not many people, like you need to transport the stuff, so wouldn't it be better to have a local solution? All things be equal, yes. So that's a good thing to incorporate. It's a good thing that if it's getting incorporated. But a lot of the stuff in terms of both the declining Alaska production and the price, certainly the international price stability, a lot of that is political. There's been huge hostility toward Alaskan oil production. I mean, there has been for a long time, even going back to Nixon preventing, you know, the pipeline connecting Prudhoe Bay. So that's part of why I say I think Alaska is a victim. So what I would wish for Alaska is to be a good advocate for drilling in Alaska and for stopping the oppression by the federal government, but then also picking whatever the, you know, having markets free so that people can pick the best solutions, including if there's a good local solution with hydro or tidal or whatever, you definitely want that. So I think of it as, yeah, you want the freedom, but in the context of there needs to be a lot more freedom to produce oil here and around the world.
Okay. Anybody else want to ask a question? Mr. Epstein, are you clocked out? Or do you have smart time?
I am basically clocked out.
Oh,
okay. If anyone has another question, but I have a...
Okay.
Yeah, I had a pretty hard stop at 3 o'clock my time. I'm not sure what it is your time. But I just say I'm very grateful, very appreciative of all the questions and comments. Everyone was very thoughtful and respectful. And I just say if anyone is interested in my book again, just email me alex@alexepstein.com. And if you're interested in getting on the best Energy Talking Points mailing list, just email me at alex@alexepstein.com and just let me know.
Okay, so we'll say thank you, Mr. Epstein. Always an interesting and exciting presentation. And we really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And I encourage all the committee members to stay in touch with you. So with that, we'll let you go then. Thank you, Mr. Epstein.
All right. Have a good day. Bye.
Thank you. Okay, is there any other business before the committee? And I'm going to make a command decision that we'll cancel our meeting on Friday. So our next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Monday, May 8th, pending, of course, the floor sessions, which, as you all know, this time of the year can really get extended. So we're really trying to kind of wrap up our business on the committee and not have any big items in front of us so that we can be flexible for floor. So any other questions? Team? Okay. Rep. Sadler.
I hope we weren't paying that gentleman by the word.
No.
We're broke now.
No. I actually had heard him present before in 2015, I think it was. And I thought you would all find it interesting. He has an interesting way to present the information. More interesting than I've ever heard it by anybody's. Okay, with that, we are adjourned at 2:04 p.m.